Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. Oh my goodness, people. What a show we're going to have today. I'm so excited that you joined me for this episode. My name is Kaveh Hoda. Hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I am going to be your host for this fun little humor-adjacent medical podcast today. God, I hope I have the emotional maturity to do this. We're talking about sex. We're talking about sexual dysfunction. And to do that, I have two special guests. First, Dr. Justin Dubin, men's healthcare specialist at Memorial Healthcare System in South Florida? South Florida?
Yep, South Florida.
I don't know correct. Why I say South Florida. Like, Florida's Florida to me. I don't know north, east, west Florida.
South Florida is very different than North Florida.
Way different.
Okay, we'll get to that. Maybe you can explain
different
to me.
Planet.
Yes, it really is.
Justin, welcome back, buddy.
Thanks for having me. Actually, I think this is my first time on the show. You were on my show.
Right. That's right. The I difference. Was at your place last time. Now you're
yes,
at our
yes,
place.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
My
good to
rules,
be here.
Motherfucker. You're in my world now. Nice. Wait, no, for real though, because I don't know anything about Florida other than Ron DeSantis and all that stuff.
Yeah.
What is the difference between North Florida and South Florida?
It's very interesting. It's actually the further south you go in Florida, the more north you go in terms of like Northeast culture. So the South Florida is traditionally a lot of people from New York, New Jersey transplants. The West Coast is Midwest transplants. And also when you're talking about Miami is South America. But when you're talking about North Florida, you're talking pretty much like the South. It's more Bible Belt, more heavy in culture in that way. So your traditional, you know, Southern person is in that Northern Florida area compared to, you know, the Southern Floridian is almost everyone has a connection to the Northeast or the Midwest to some degree.
Oh, that's interesting. Second question, what happened to your voice?
Yeah, so terrible timing on my part. I went to Halloween Horror Nights. I go every year in Orlando for me and my buddy annual trip. And, you know, we do two parks in 24 hours. I got there at 8 a.m., left at midnight. We hit both parks, Universal Studios and Islands of Adventure. And then we stayed over to the 10 haunted houses that they have at night. Incredible experience. But I was screaming so much, I lost my voice. It's really fun. Highly recommend it.
By buddy. Do you mean a child that you took to these things, or was this another grown ass adult that you took?
This was a grown ass man. He is my best friend growing up. Shout out Matt Gallo. He works for the Today
Good
Show.
Guy.
He's a producer on the Today Show.
Good
and
Good
you know,
dude.
He hooks
great
up.
Hair.
Great dude.
Yeah.
Great hair. He has actually excellent hair.
I believe it. Also joining us. Oh my goodness. I'm so excited to have you. You've definitely been on the show before. Now I'm not getting that incorrect. Dr. Ashley Winter. She is a board certified urologist who is a specialist in sexual health and sexual medicine in the greater LA area. Dr. Winter, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for coming back.
Thanks for having me. And sorry if I butted in before you introduced me. It's like, what is this random voice popping in?
Ashley, my listeners have such low expectations for me. You have no idea. It's okay.
It's like the way of thinking of, like, as he was saying, Florida, right? South Florida, like, remember in Seinfeld, like, all the parents in Seinfeld lived in Florida, right? And they were like
Del Boca Vista Estates,
right? They lived in South Florida, right?
Correct. And then,
right, North Florida is Bible Belt adjacent. So
yeah,
yes. I mean, I don't want you guys judging me for this, but I didn't watch a lot of Seinfeld. I understand.
That's not good.
Listen, I understand. You don't understand. It's a great show. I get it. It was for the time, it was amazing. My problem wasn't so much the show. It's kind of like my same problem with Pink Floyd and the Lakers. It's the fans. It's not the show itself. It's like the Seinfeld guys that would just do nothing. Their whole sense of humor revolved around quoting Seinfeld episodes. I couldn't handle it. The whole thing made me want to distance myself as far as I could. But I get the reference, sure. Yeah, Seinfeld.
What about Curb?
Same problem.
Do you like Curb?
Also, cringe humor gets me. I don't dig the cringe humor. Maybe I'm a little on the spectrum, I'm not sure, but like,
God.
Humor, the whole time it's like chewing on tinfoil. I don't love it. You guys,
my husband's gonna be on a Curb episode this upcoming season.
Oh, that's so awesome.
He filmed
that's
it like so 2 days awesome. Before our Did... child was born, and I think my water had broken, but I didn't tell him because I didn't want him to be distracted when he had to go film.
Oh, wow.
Like, did he get to meet RFK's wife?
Oh, yes, he did. Yes, he did.
Oh, that must have been fun. How is she?
I think she's like super chill. Like, I don't know anything about their relationship, but yeah, I think in real life she's super chill. So I'll
try not to blame her for her husband's.
Yeah, I wouldn't blame her. I would blame him.
Yeah.
Although she does hang out. I mean, she does seem to be fully on board. It's like pictures of like her and him together with like Jordan Peterson, like on, you know, both sides of him, and him and her together, like doing these things, like going to like the Samoan Islands to like meet with like their president and convince him to not do like vaccinations. And so I'm not going to let her off the hook. But you know what? I'm not going to put you on the hook for your husband hanging out with her, which is a whole, like, multiple levels of separation. So,
yeah. No, look, I'm not pro anti-vaxxer. That sucks. And yes. And I don't know. But I guess I wouldn't not watch Curb.
No, I'm going to watch the shit out of your husband's episode.
Thank you.
We all are.
That's the one episode I'm going to watch, Ashley. I want him, let him know. That's the one episode of the whole Seinfeld universe, the Seinfeld verse, that I will watch, will be the one that he's on.
And I will tell you, like, for what it's worth, Larry David was, like, he said, Larry David, like, you know, when he wasn't filming, he had a mask on, like, didn't want to, you know, maybe like elbow bump, but like not shake your hand. Like, that guy definitely was cognizant of infectious diseases. So at least let's give Larry David, you know, his due in this. Right. I don't know how
Shout
we got
out Larry
on
David.
The
this is the show. This is the show. This is what we're talking about. This is what we're talking about.
States in Florida.
No, yeah. No. Okay. That's what we're going to talk about today is sexual dysfunction, sexual issues.
Great segue.
Let me ask you two guys, how much of your practice is taking care of sexual dysfunction? You're both in the world of urology, so there are other things, cancers and such and all that. But how much of your practice is dealing with sexual dysfunction?
Ashley?
Sure. Well, okay. So my career since training has been in a few different environments. For the first 5 years that I was in attending, I was at a Kaiser system, which, you know, for those of you in areas that have Kaiser or don't, you know, to explain, it's a large managed care organization. And there, just everybody was expected to do some amount of general urology. And I'd say, you know, what fell under straight up sexual medicine was probably you know, at least 60% of my practice in terms of like Peyronie's disease, penile implants, anorgasmia, you know, things like that. But then I'd say there was also this other component that oftentimes falls in like the female space, where things that people came into thinking that it into my clinic thinking it was a general urology concern, like recurrent UTIs, I actually had to educate them about like genitourinary syndrome of menopause, right? And teach them about how hormones affected their symptoms that they thought were general urology concerns or urinary concerns, and actually had this like intersectionality with hormone health. And so that is something that I was empowered to treat well because of my sexual medicine training. So in some way, I feel like sexual medicine became like, in effect, ended up being like 80% of what I did. Sexual medicine means a lot of different things, and this is a very long, complicated answer, but I think a lot of people just think sexual medicine is like hormones and erectile dysfunction and penis, and it's a lot more than that, right? It's really, in my mind, the intersectionality of urology, hormonal health, and like quality of life medicine as it relates to pelvic organs. If that's a very long answer.
I think that's a great answer. And, you know, for my, I agree with everything you said. I would say about 50% of my practice is sexual health, but when you kind of pull back the layers, like Ashley says, you end up having people come in for one thing and you find out that they're like, oh, well, while I'm here, I also maybe have this issue. And I think just to summarize what Ashley was saying is that sexual health is health, and it is often a warning sign of, or something potentially happening down the pipeline in your health, or something that is a side effect of something bad happening in your health. And we'll discuss that very thoroughly in this episode, I'm sure. But, you know, someone comes in and very often I'm sending them for a sleep study. I'm sending them to a cardiologist. I'm sending them to an endocrinologist. I've diagnosed diabetes. I've diagnosed heart disease. I've diagnosed sleep apnea, just to name, you know, spine injuries. I send them for, you know, to a spine surgeon. These are all things that, you know, sometimes their penis not working is the first thing that gets them in the door, yeah. But they leave with so many other issues that we have to assess, whether it's hormones or these other things.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting to me that there are going to be that a pretty, I'm sure, sizable group of patients where that's how you get them to seek medical care. It's that their sexual dysfunction, and that's what's the final straw that gets them into a doctor's office. That's interesting. Well, you know, usually when we think of urologists, I think most people think of treating male patients, but we're talking about a lot of female patients as well, and a lot of female issues. And I did a little bit of looking into this before I had you guys come on, and it looks like sexual problems are reported by about 40% of women worldwide, and about 12%, it's like one in every eight women, have a sexual problem that is associated with some significant personal distress. So, Ashley, let me start with you. What are the most common forms of sexual dysfunction that female patients come to you with?
Yeah, great question. And I would say probably the incidence of these conditions is even higher. It's just that
100%.
Women don't realize that sex shouldn't have to be painful, or that sex shouldn't have to lack pleasure, or sex shouldn't have to be dry, or, you know, so it's that women are so uneducated about sexual function and their bodies that they don't even know to begin to identify that there's a problem. So it's reported as massive, and I think it's way more massive than that. So yeah, and your basic question was like basically, you know, about those conditions was that, sorry, I lost track.
What are the most common?
Yeah, I'd say probably the most common would be sexual pain conditions. So pain with penetration, you know, near the introitus, pain that's deep pain, right? That can be from conditions like what are considered vestibulodynia or vulvodynia, which is pain, you know, around the external genitalia. And then, you know, deep dyspareunia or deep pain is associated more commonly with things like endometriosis. These things can also be related to pelvic floor dysfunction, bladder pain syndromes. So that's a huge basket. And then I'd say the other would be, well, they're all super common.
Well, so, actually, let me ask you a question real quick. I guess I understand the causes of deep pain. Like if there's big fibroids, if there is something happening that's causing an impingement there, I could see pain. But what's causing that more superficial vulvar pain that you'd mentioned? What is that?
I love you asking this. This is such a great question.
I'm pretty great.
You are so great.
Pretty great.
I know. And right. And it's so funny because I think people typically think of pain in women when they have sex, like some huge penis, like pounding it really hard and that hurts or something. Right. But it's actually extremely common where the pain is superficial, like right at the openings, meaning something that even prevents penetration in the first place, or, you know, it gets in, but it doesn't have to be related to like how intense the sex is or how big the penetrative object is, right? Like not at all. So that like vulvar pain, vulvodynia or vestibulodynia, the most common, and I'll try not to be too long with this, but the most common reason for that is usually related to hormones. So it's really prevalent in women in peri and postmenopause due to lack of estrogen and testosterone, because the tissue around the opening of the introitus, like right at the opening of the vagina, is this thing called the vulvar vestibule. And it's this piece of tissue that like nobody really understands that it's a, like its own organ. It's where a lot of the lubrication associated with sex comes from. And a lot of the fluid secreted by it is like the equivalent of pre-cum in men. So it's that same quality of like stuff that makes you wet. Like men get wet, it's pre-cum, right? And that organ is very hormone sensitive. And if there's low hormones, then it can become raw, irritated. Like it would be like, you know, trying to rub something across a scrape, right? Like you scraped your knee and now someone's going to rub something on it. Like that would suck, right? So if your hormones are low, you can develop this situation at that ring of tissue that feels really horrible. Now it can be from menopause, perimenopause. It can also be in younger women, oftentimes related to birth control, because birth control actually suppresses estradiol and testosterone, right? So you think of taking like hormonal contraceptives and you think you're actually getting more hormones, and it is a hormone, but it suppresses your natural production. And so you can actually get a pain syndrome there. Now, not everybody who takes combined oral contraceptive pills get this pain syndrome, but many do. And it's really tough because a lot of young women are put on the pill before they become sexually active so that they don't get pregnant, right? Like, oh, hey, you've gone through puberty. Why don't you consider going on the pill? Have you had sex yet? No, why don't you start this, right? And then they think it's normal that it hurts when they have sex, and they didn't know that there was any other way it could be. And again, I am somebody who's super, super pro contraception, but there's also a great societal misunderstanding on the sexual side effects of birth control. And like, we need better informed consent around that stuff. So yeah.
Is it just oral birth control?
This is a great question. So oral combined contraceptive pills raise sex hormone binding globulin,
SHBG.
Yes. For everybody listening, that's like a protein that floats around in your blood. Okay. And the reason is because it's a hormone and it's taken by mouth. So it's processed by your liver. And like Justin will know this, like if somebody takes oral testosterone in the traditional formulations, that affects your liver and your sex hormone binding globulin goes up. So it's not great to take any sort of hormone by mouth. And unfortunately, the most common hormone that people take by mouth, not any type of hormone, but certain steroid hormones, and the most common type of steroid hormone that people take by mouth is the combined oral contraceptive pill, right? So that raises this SHBG and it lowers the bioavailable testosterone in 100% of people who take it, right? And we know that testosterone is important in women, and it's definitely important in their genitals, and the lack of it can lead to genital pain. It can also lead to lack of libido. So we actually are giving what millions, if not hundreds of millions of people worldwide combine oral contraceptives pills that 100% of the time lower bioavailable testosterone in women and can lead to sexual pain conditions and can lead to low libido. So if that's like, if I'm not explaining that well, let me know, but it's a huge
100% sense. Makes 100% sense.
Well, right. And this is, oh yeah. Just one last thing. This is why things like IUDs are amazing, because IUDs can, like, even though progesterone based IUDs are hormonal contraceptive and can suppress ovulation, right? They don't have the same effect on the sex hormone binding globulin. So there's less sexual side effects in terms of libido and pain. So, yeah.
So just real quick though, getting back to something you had mentioned, I mean, we think of birth control, and I think most of the general public, you know, gets the concept of there being hormones in it, but you also mentioned combined hormones, and you mentioned steroid as well. Where is the steroid aspect of this? And can you explain that to our listeners, how that plays a part in this?
Yeah. Great question. So the combined oral contraceptive pill is what I'm talking about. And generally that is defined by having a synthetic estrogen. So the most common thing is something called ethinyl estradiol. And so again, you're taking that and it's quite potent, but usually it's in these ultra low doses. So it's potent enough to suppress your ovulation, but then it will decrease the endogenous level of other estrogens in your body. And that's why it can lead to things like genital atrophy and stuff, right? And then also it will contain a progestin. So something in the family of some like synthetic hormones that are related to progesterone. Now, there's a problem because not only can these drugs affect testosterone levels through this SHBG I mentioned earlier, but some of these progestins have a direct anti-androgen or anti-testosterone effect. So a really common one is desperinone. So that is like a double whammy, and the sexual side effects of that one are really bad, and it's really shitty because that one is given so often for these extra benefits of like clear skin, right? And why does it clear up your skin? Because it fucks up your testosterone. So it gets rid of all your zits, because a lot of zits are mediated through androgen levels, right? Like that's why when you go through puberty, you get all these zits, is because your testosterone levels spike and you get zits. And so we're just saying to women, hey, you'll have clear skin and be pretty, because we're like, you're not chemically castrating them, but you're like, you're messing with really important hormones, right? Like, why wouldn't you say, if your problem is acne, try something topical first, right? Like, if your problem is acne, why wouldn't you do something less invasive first, right? Like, but for teenage women, we just say, oh, here, ablate your androgens so you can look nice, right? You might spend the next 20 years of your life having painful sex and no sex drive, and you'll never understand why, and nobody will ever explain it to you. Sorry, I get like really, really passionate about this topic. And you guys think, you know, oh, is this just a women's issue? Like, just think how many times in your dating life you may have met someone or had this concordance in your sex drive. Like, was that person on the oral contraceptive pill? Like, how much did they not even know, like, their innate desire to have sex or what it would be like to have pain-free sex? Like, the ramifications of all this are like huge. And I, again, it's not the case with everybody. Some people do great with these medications, but like, I think there should be a giant warning label on all of them. And I think that it should be part of the informed consent conversation every single time.
And that makes a lot of sense. I'm glad you brought that up. Just to be clear, kind of also what I was getting at is, I think a lot of listeners would probably be confused when they hear steroids, because they think steroids, they think like either prednisone, like a steroid for a chronic asthma sort of inflammatory issue, or like anabolic steroids. And we're not really talking about that kind of steroid. So just want to make that part clear there.
No, it was a great point of clarification.
And so, you know, we're talking about hormones in regards to women's healthcare, but Justin, what about the most commonly used hormones for men's health? Are you getting a lot of testosterone questions these days? I know a lot of men who are really excited about taking testosterone. A lot of people who feel really strongly that it's gotten a bad rap out in the public and feel that's healthy and they try to push it. And how are you answering these questions? What are the questions you're getting and how are you answering them?
Now more than ever is really everyone's talking about testosterone. You have a million podcasts out there talking about optimization. They're using words like optimization and all these drugs. And it's become concerning enough so that actually, you know, in December we published in JAMA Internal Medicine, a secret shopper where I actually was a secret shopper for direct to consumer online testosterone clinics. What we did is we found 7 clinics or companies on a national level that provided care to all 50 states. And what we did was I pretended to just be me. I was at the time a young 34-year-old man. Mm-hmm. And I went with a script saying I had signs and symptoms of low testosterone. I said erectile dysfunction. Yeah, low T, erectile dysfunction, low energy, issues gaining muscle mass, weight gain. But the important thing I did mention was that I was married and that I wanted to have future children. And for our listeners who aren't aware, one of the biggest side effects of taking testosterone in any capacity is that it causes infertility. About 65% of men who have sperm develop what we call azoospermia, zero sperm in their ejaculate, only within about 4 months of using it. Now, that's obviously concerning. And as more and more men are trying to get on these things, the education in terms of the risks and benefits have to be known. So when I went into this, I had clearly and distinctly said that I want to have future children with my partner. And 6 of the 7, and I also got blood work. I got legitimate blood work. My testosterone levels were normal. According to the AUA guidelines, threshold of 300 total testosterone is considered low. Mine was around 650, no big deal, but
brag. Check out Justin bragging about his testosterone. Take that, cucks.
Hey, well, yeah, the funny thing is, if it was bad, it would have been, the study wouldn't have worked. So yeah, I got very lucky that, right. So I had great testosterone levels.
Yeah,
I wanted to get testosterone. 6 of the 7 companies offered me testosterone, even though I wanted to have fertility and having normal testosterone levels. What does this mean? It means that, you know, a lot of people are being put on T, and I also do infertility care. And I cannot tell you how many young men I am seeing these days who are on testosterone, who were not told that it caused fertility. And we have to manage these people appropriately by taking them off of testosterone sometimes and putting them on other medications like Clomid or HCG, which can, innately build your fertility and your own testosterone levels up naturally. But we've come to a point where some of these guys now, even with their partners in here, they're saying they feel so good on the testosterone that they don't even want to come off. So I have to put them on a combination of things. And, you know, it's a very interesting world we're currently living in. And, you know, one of the arguments always becomes, well, why can't we just put everyone on T? Is there a problem? Because, you know, we have a new study came out, a really big study came out in New England Journal of Medicine about, I don't know what, 2 months ago, because there was always a concern of risk of testosterone usage and stroke, heart attack, cardiovascular risk. They did a great randomized trial that showed it did not increase the risk. And we already know having low testosterone puts you at risk for heart attack, stroke, diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, all these other comorbidities. So putting you on T is actually very helpful for a lot of men. But if you don't need it, just like anything, more does not necessarily mean better. There's ample studies showing that men who've been treated at a supratherapeutic, and remember this New England study showed that they were at therapeutic levels, supratherapeutic levels. Yeah, you can get a heart attack, you can get a stroke, you can have all these health issues. And you look at all these studies of bodybuilders where they're going through it and they all have comorbidities. And, you know, I remember I was sitting with Dr. Ranjit Ramaswamy, who's a mentor of mine. So I'm giving him a shout out because he said this. We were at a meeting and we were having a conversation, and one urologist says, why don't we just give everyone testosterone? It makes them feel better. They're doing better. He's like, well, heroin feels good for you, but more doesn't necessarily mean it's always better for your health. And I think that's a pretty accurate assessment also for testosterone. You know, you're putting people on something for life most of the time, if they don't need to be, and we're promising them solutions for maybe some other underlying issue, right? Signs and symptoms of low testosterone are very, very, very general, except for usually like a low libido or something like that. Mm-hmm. But in general, they can be so many other things. They can be super tentoral. They could be depression, anxiety, and stuff like that. So, you know, people going online and seeing things like, oh, maybe I just have low testosterone, and going to one of these clinics and saying, hey, yeah, you don't have low testosterone technically, but we want to make you feel better. Yeah. That's a problem.
Yeah.
I would say another important to piggyback on that comment. We so intensely conflate low T with all these virile sexual traits that people mm-hmm. end up getting ineffective treatments. And so what do I mean by that? So And I would also say another thing, right, like about the secret shopper that's important to note is, you know, these direct to consumer space has definitely shown a light on the way testosterone is being misused. But there have been local, quote unquote, T clinics for many years that have been doing the same thing. So this isn't something that's happened mm-hmm. with like direct to consumer telehealth in the last few years. Like that is clearly a problem based on Justin's study with, you know, certain DTC telehealth providers, but it's been a problem for decades, honestly. But anyway, to my original point. So in my last job, right, I would, like when I was working at this Kaiser, I would have men come in all the time, and they had gone to this local T clinic, basically where people go to say, I have erectile dysfunction, and get put on T, whether or not their T was normal, right? And 99% of the time, it wouldn't fix the problem, right? And the reason is because if you have a very healthy cardiovascular system, and you just happen to have extremely low testosterone, let's say from a pituitary tumor, then correcting your testosterone is going to give your erections back, your erections back, right? But if you have a penis that is unhealthy for some other reason, like, and you have cardiovascular disease and your erections are not working well, and your T happens to be normal, giving you more T is not going to fix your erections. And we have so conflated these virile characteristics with having high T that men come in and they're like, I was put on more T and more T and more T and more T, and my erections never came back. And they had not come to a urologist. And I was like, hey, we have to start from square one. This isn't a testosterone problem because your T is normal and you're not getting hard, right? And we have to think about other strategies. So that's another danger of, you know, misunderstanding the power of testosterone.
I think it's an amazing topic. I think it's really interesting that one company at least said, no, your T is normal, your testosterone levels are normal, and didn't give it to you. I'm almost shocked that there was one of seven companies that did that. How was that when they told you? Were you kind of surprised that they did that? What did they say to you? They said, no, you're good, you don't need this.
Well, they said you're not eligible for this, but you know, that didn't mean they didn't offer me things. there's, you know, other things you can be offered. They just didn't offer me testosterone. I didn't meet criteria. Now, there's a lot of other medications. I did mention HCG, Clomid. I don't believe I was offered those by that company. I have to, you know,
client for something else.
Correct. Right. Now, listen, I'm coming to them with an issue, just like anyone else. So, you know, I don't get me wrong. I am not against direct to consumer either. I am very pro telemedicine. I think we all are. I mean, I'm very pro telehealth. I'm very pro direct to consumer, but I think we have to understand that, you know, there are, you know, risks and benefits of these things. And you know, testosterone is a class 3 controlled substance, and it is for a reason, although some people may argue against that at this point.
I think it shouldn't be a class. I don't think it should
yes.
be
a
substance.
Nobody ends up in the gutter, like, in jail.
I agree. I agree with that.
I have some reservations about direct health advertisement, and I have some reservations about telehealth. But speaking of which, stay tuned. We'll be right back. Here are some commercials from Better Health or whatever. Don't listen to any of them. I don't approve these advertisements. So whatever you hear in the following advertisements, you can soundly ignore. We'll be right back.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
All right, welcome back. I hope you really enjoyed all those advertisements about dick pills and mattresses and whatever other garbage they put in there. Don't buy it. Anyways, let's talk about anorgasmia. I want to talk about anorgasmia. I think it's an interesting topic. I want to talk about from both the female and the male perspective. Let's start first with you, Ashley. Can you tell us a little bit about how common it is in women?
Well, there's the existence of women not having orgasms because they or their partners are not educated about how to achieve their orgasms. And then there's true physiologic anorgasmia. And those are two very different things. And I think the first is extremely common and the second is not actually super common.
Wait, how do you bring that out in a patient interview? When you're talking to a patient, how do you get to the point where you're like, I'm sorry, but the problem probably is your lover sucks. Like, they're not doing it. How do you get to that point in a conversation with a patient?
Well, I'll tell you for one thing, and I'm sure Justin can say this too. When you do sexual medicine frequently and for many years, you just become so comfortable at talking about this stuff. Like, you know, for 100%. The regular people, like, you're not hanging out with your friends at the barbecue being like, well, you know, when you have sex, like, where does your husband put his finger? You know, like, you're not usually saying that, but like at work, I'm talking about that all the time, right? So, So like, I remember, you know, often it would come up, particularly, I think, in certain generations of females, you know, let's say the boomer generation and up in my patients, like who have just had certain fewer exposures in terms of their health expectations and their health literacy. And, you know, it turning out like, hey, you know, I don't think I've ever had an orgasm. And then I'd be like, well, tell me a little bit, you know, about how you get stimulated during sex. And then I'll, you know, describe POV and like no manual external genital stimulation. Right. And so it's not super hard to get at, you know, and I'll be like, hey, have you ever touched, you know, do you masturbate? Like, how do you masturbate? Have you ever touched your clitoris? Do you know where your clitoris is? And sometimes they have no, am I allowed to curse? Because they have no fucking idea. And like, and I sit there with somebody who's, you know, sometimes twice my age, and we use a hand mirror and I show them where their clitoris is. And I give them, I say, go home and try stimulating this, because this is the equivalent of the penis. And like, I can promise you, you know, I mean, this is, I'm using a lot of like heteronormative discussion points here, but like, if you've had a male partner, they've been looking at the equivalent of this organ every single day of their entire lives. Like, go and look at it. Like, it's just as important for sexual pleasure. Like, look at your clitoris. So
more of a generational thing, you feel?
I'd say it's far more common that I have people that have been in like sexually active for decades. I mean, sexually active for long periods of time and have never had an orgasm who are older women.
It's crazy. And I think just to highlight that, you know, there is this thing called the orgasm gap. And it's something that's very, very important to understand when we're talking about anorgasmia, especially in heteronormative relationships, heterosexual relationships, where, you know, only about 20 to 30% of women really achieve orgasm through penetrative intercourse. And, you know, there was a couple studies showing that, you know, while 91% of men say that they usually are always experiencing orgasm with partnered sex, only about 39%, and that might even be low, during you know, the partnered sex. So, you know, this idea when we're talking about orgasm and is a male focused one for, you know, and that's kind of, you know, sex ends after the man orgasms is unfortunately how a lot of societal thoughts are, instead of like, hey, I'm not like, let's do this together. Maybe how do you get off asking your partner, you know, is it penetrative? Is there other things going on and how we can achieve this together? So unfortunately for a lot of women, and I speak with men mostly, I don't really deal with female side, but I do often ask about this stuff as well, because it is important to achieve, you know, a partner's goal of, you know, satisfying each other.
And also understanding how to stimulate, a woman ties into other sexual conditions, right? Like,
absolutely.
You may have pain with sex, but if you stimulate your partner appropriately, maybe she won't have painful sex because she's appropriately lubricated, mm-hmm. right? Like that. So it can tie into pain conditions. But, mm-hmm. To your original question about anorgasmia. So really, you know, when you think of a real physical anorgasmia, right? There's a few main categories. So the most common would be like medication induced, right? People who, for example, like SSRIs, particularly high doses of SSRIs. So for people who don't know, an SSRI is a type of antidepressant. And those in both men and women can notoriously make it more difficult to climax. So that can be, for some people, either anorgasmia or delayed orgasm. There can be like neurologic basis. Again, that's not as common, but definitely like if you have really advanced diabetes, you can have peripheral nerve damage that can cause problems achieving orgasm, again, in both men and women. And this is like, right, uncontrolled diabetes is probably the number one most common, like one of the number one most common causes of sexual dysfunction in all genders, erectile dysfunction, mm-hmm. arousal mm-hmm. disorder, orgasm dysfunction, because it makes your nerves stop working. Like, right? It's crazy. Absolutely. So it doesn't have to be that you just have a spinal cord injury for you to have sex, like neurologic sexual dysfunction. Like it can be peripheral nervous, like, you know, like neurologic conditions, peripheral neurologic damage. And then there's like what we call end organ or like end organ problems, right? So that would be like an actual problem with the clitoris that is causing somebody to have a difficulty orgasm. So the classic example would be like a phimosis, right? And so a phimosis is when the foreskin is fused over the glands or the tip of the organ, right? And typically you think about this with a penis, you can have phimosis of the penis. That's when the foreskin doesn't retract, right? And you can't see the glands. But this can also happen with the clitoral hood. And it is actually like quite common. And I have seen people come in and say they have pain with arousal or they can't have an orgasm. And you look and their clitoris, like the hood of the clitoris and the labia is completely fused and you can't even see the tip of the clitoris. Mm-hmm. And that's a very treatable problem. And it's not infrequent. And like, so again, it's so important to examine these things and break them down into different conditions, because I think classically woman says, oh, I can't orgasm. And you're like, drink a glass of wine or experiment. And it's like, it might be
so fucked up.
It might be a physical thing that can be fixed and have nothing to do with wine or watching sexy movies, you know?
Right. So it sounds like the treatments are really varied based on what the problem is, and it can be anything from like using the appropriate lubrication to like a surgical option if there's something that needs like the clitoral hood needs to be released, for example. And what you do, and when you're talking to these patients, at what point do you feel like that you've done everything you can and there isn't anything left to do? Is that ever happened that you've tried everything physiologically, there's no obvious problem and there's no surgical issue, the lubrication issue doesn't seem to be a problem? At that point, do you have to assume it's a psychological thing? At what point is it out of your hands and do you say, I want you to see a therapist or something? Or do you even at that point say, look, not everyone has orgasms and that's okay? What do you do in those situations?
Interesting question.
Exhausted everything.
Yeah. So that's a very less common and unique condition, right? Like usually if somebody's has a regular hormone levels, let's say they're not on an SSRI, they're not on a combined oral contraceptive pill, as we discussed previously, they have a visible glans clitoris on exam. They are, stimulating the clitoris with either, a vibrator or a finger. Like usually when you meet these criteria, there will be an orgasm. Exceedingly rare to not be able to achieve it under all those criteria, right? Which is an amazing thing because usually checking those boxes isn't too hard. Now, certainly there are times when people still don't orgasm despite all of those things. And it's been like that lifelong. That's typically something we call like primary anorgasmia. And again, pretty rare. In those instances, sometimes you'll try certain medications, not because you think there's a psychological thing, but because there's like a neurochemical thing, right? So sometimes you think of kind of the pro-orgasm neurotransmitter as being dopamine, right? Dopamine is like associated with lots of pleasurable sensations. And so like some people just, due to their physiology or their genes, I mean, why are some people more predisposed to being depressed, right? Some sort of severe depression, regardless of life circumstances, right? Like some of that's just a neurochemical thing, right? So for those people, you can try different things that target dopamine. There's no specific medications that are FDA approved for this. And other neurochemicals related to this. So like, for example, the medication flibanserin, which is FDA approved for hypoactive sexual desire disorder or low sex drive, and technically only FDA approved for that in premenopausal women. It doesn't work on sex hormones. It works in the brain. It's this like mixed serotonin agonist antagonist that basically shifts the brain into this like pro-dopamine space. I won't bore you on like the nitty-gritty of that, but in people of any gender who have difficulty not only with desire but even with orgasm, I have seen benefit. So that is certainly something you can try. It's also good for people who have anorgasmia from medications like antidepressants. So you can try that. Again, there's not large studies on this, unfortunately, because I think the funding isn't there and because the metrics are not excellent. So getting FDA approval for like orgasm based metrics is just hard to do, right? Sure. Like for cancer therapeutics, it's like how many people died in this 6 month period, right? Like, so there's that. And then the really kind of more bootstrap, kind of low tech option is other dopamine agonists. Like you can, I have prescribed Parkinson's meds to these people. So think medications like cabergoline, they're very cheap and they are dopamine agonists, right? So because Parkinson's disease is a dopamine, like low levels of dopamine in certain parts of the brain, right? And so, and those medications increase dopamine in the brain, and they're cheap and easy to prescribe. the main downside with them is, like, again, there's not much efficacy data. They work for some people, they don't work for others, and they can increase compulsive behaviors. So if you have like a gambling problem or like a substance use disorder, they can be problematic and cause you to like spiral down those paths.
Mary, I didn't know that. That's
yeah, and it's a fascinating thing because that's associated with that part of your brain that craves, right? So you can like start craving sex and you can potentially orgasm, but then you might end up in the casino. So and you'll find, like, you can ask people who are, you know, have Parkinson's and are high doses of these medications, sometimes their reward centers are affected by this, right? Like, you may have known somebody who has Parkinson's who's actually has like a raging sex drive. It's fascinating stuff. Yeah.
That is really interesting. Let me ask you, Justin, how common is anorgasmia in men? Is that something that you see? And I'm not talking about erectile dysfunction, like in terms of difficulty getting an erection. Do you ever see patients where that's not the issue? They can get an erection, but they just can't bring themselves to orgasm. Does that happen?
Yeah. Sorry. Yes, it is. It's something that we see. And I think you have to kind of understand the physiology to get there, because when we're talking about men specifically, you have to understand that you can orgasm, and orgasm and ejaculation are two different things. You can not ejaculate and orgasm. You can orgasm without ejaculating. So you have to kind of have an understanding where, you know, often I see guys with erectile dysfunction and I still ask if they're able to achieve orgasm, and some of them have a very soft penis and they say nothing comes out, but I achieve orgasm and I'm very, very happy with my sex life. I don't really care. Some people can't get an erection and then they can't orgasm and they're not happy. Some people get a great erection and they just never achieve orgasm. Usually those are the guys who don't orgasm and ejaculate together. So, you know, just kind of understanding that pathway. So, you know, your parasympathetics kind of give you your erection, and your sympathetics are usually the point and shoot is what we like to call it. The sympathetics have a role with your ejaculation. And you know, in order to ejaculate, you have the emission where your semen is pushed out into the urethra by the contraction of the prostate, seminal vesicles, vas deferens. And then, you know, you have the bladder neck contraction, right? And this part's very important when you're talking about ejaculation. And you often see people with diabetes, prostate surgeries, you know, that bladder neck is compromised. So you can orgasm and nothing comes out. And some of these guys tell me, oh, I didn't orgasm. And I'm like, well, do you feel the sensation? Yes, but nothing came out. And so, you know, sometimes you have to educate your patient on what they're actually going through because, you know, sometimes this is not very common knowledge stuff, right? Is the next question. But yeah.
All right. Question for you. I'd love to see if you've had this experience as well. I have noted a number of patients actually say to me after a prostate cancer surgery, they have become multi-orgasmic and that their orgasms are more powerful than before. And obviously they don't ejaculate anymore because they don't have a prostate. But it's like rewired things in their pelvis and it's fascinating. And like, most of the men I know of that are multi-orgasmic actually don't have a prostate anymore.
I have not had that, but that's very, very interesting. And just to kind of pick up on that, you can have something called climacteria in these guys who have had their prostates removed, where instead of having ejaculate, which they don't have anymore because their prostate seminal vesicles removed, actually a little bit of urine comes out. And a lot of people don't like that. And that's something that you sometimes have to address as well. But you know, when we're talking about
How do you address that? How would you address that? Seems like a very tricky, sometimes issue to deal with.
Oftentimes I tell them to empty their bladder prior to engaging in sexual activity is really the best way to do it. And then sometimes I just provide them with reassurance. I'm like, oh, a little pee is not the worst thing in the world. I don't know. It's Ashley, how do you usually recommend, how do you guide these people?
Yeah, I mean, usually it's empty your bladder, and you know that it's normal, and you know, for the most part, you know, it's the person caring more than their partner caring.
Correct.
And you know, just doing those education points, if it's something that they're outrageously bothered by, and they're more than a year after surgery, and they've already gone to pelvic floor physical therapy and kind of optimized their healing and all that good stuff, then, you know, you can do, like, you could discuss, like, for example, a sling, a male sling, a urethral sling, but typically those are better for incontinence, and they're really not going to optimize any sort of climacteria. The final thing that I didn't mention is just like using a cock ring, right? So cock rings can, you know, they'll put pressure on the urethra. So, you know, you can use those. And some men do have really good resolution of climacteria just with a cock ring. So that's another thing you can do.
Any risk of using a cock ring while we're speaking about it for people who don't have those underlying issues, like for a typical patient, like, is there anything to be concerned about?
I think we're all, Ashley and I will agree, cock rings, constriction bands, similar names, whatever you want. I think we're all for them. Very good products, but you have to be careful on the kind of product you use. You have to understand how familiar you are with these products. You know, we've all, as urologists during residency, I've sawed off a few cock rings.
No metal cock rings
are bad. You want elastic cock
rings.
Something that you can, you know, stretch that has some give, so that, God forbid, you know, it gets stuck, you know, and, you know, you're kind of creating, you know, an issue where it's swollen and you can't get it off. We can remove it, or you can remove it either with a knife or scissors or something like that. Now, the key
it shouldn't
really
involve
not...
the fire department to get off of you.
Correct. Correct.
Just don't get one of those.
And it might look cool or whatever, but just don't do it. And I think the key is timing. Like, you don't want to keep it on longer than 20 or 30 minutes. You know, most sexual interactions aren't lasting that long anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not keeping it on long, understanding what kind of product you're using, and then, you know, understanding your body as well. You know, it's in general, though, they're very, very safe and very effective and very helpful. And I often tell guys, you know, you can really optimize if the Viagra or the Cialis isn't taking you where you want to be, even with penile implants, with you know, it can help get your glands a little bit more full, with Trimix, the injections in your penis. You can, it's always a nice add-on if you really want to make it really strong.
And then I will interject after this. I am, as a disclosure, on the scientific advisory board of a product called FirmTech, which makes both a smart cock ring, so it's like a Fitbit cock ring, but also
I have one right over here.
Yeah, okay. And we also make one that's not a smart version, but it's actually made of a type of elastomer, and it has a type of design where it's actually safe to wear overnight if you want to monitor your nocturnal tumescence. So the number and strength of your nighttime erections can be a indicator of your overall cardiovascular health. So some people can wear it for that and track their nighttime erections. So that one, the first...
Wow, you guys
is safe to wear overnight.
It's a great design. I'm not associated in any way. It's a great design.
And you can wear that one overnight. It's a great, if you're somebody who likes to fall asleep immediately after your orgasm, I know people like that, including, you know, my husband, then it's great.
Don't we all, though? It's tiring.
It's so tiring.
I know.
I want to go to bed afterwards. Speaking of toys, do you ever recommend the use of vibrators for anorgasmia? And is there ever a problem with a woman who can only use a vibrator, gets to a point where they only use a vibrator? And by the way, if that's fine, we certainly don't need men or other partners, women for that matter. But is there ever a time when you tell someone to maybe ease off the use of a vibrator?
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, it's always to the, like, if somebody's having personal distress due to the extent that they're using a vibrator, then, you know, of course, I'm going to counsel them to reduce it. Is there an exact number? Probably not. Like, there's not an exact cutoff. I mean, if somebody's like, hey, I'm, you know, using a vibrator 4 hours a day, and I feel isolated from my friends, and I don't date, and I'm scared to have intimacy because of my vibrator use, then, like, yeah, that's a problem, right? If somebody's using it every single day and they're having a few orgasms and they feel great, like, I don't care. So So it's really, I think, related to that personal distress and the impact on interpersonal relationships, right? And if somebody, if somebody is interested in having partner sexual activity, and not everybody is interested in that, but if you are interested in personal, you know, partnered sexual activity, then I think, you know, it is important to say, how are ways that we can effectively work the vibrator into partnered sexual activity, mm-hmm. so that can enhance that, right? And it doesn't mean you can't also go off and masturbate. Like, masturbation is normal, even if you have partnered sexual
activity. Hell yeah.
But it's important to
Yeah. And listen, I'm going to just piggyback off of her for a second, because we think sex toys, we think women. Especially anorgasmia, delay to orgasm, I recommend oftentimes guys get sex toys themselves. And, you know, that vibrator.
I literally have a box of like all of them.
Shout out Hot Octopus. I recommend Hot Octopus products all the time. They have different products. You know, one looks like a taco you put your penis in, and then it vibrates at the tip. And, you know, women are stimulated by vibration. But guess what, guys? The penis also has that vibratory stimulation. And I think for a lot of guys, it can really, you know, help them get over the edge of that delayed orgasm. And, you know, you can get so aroused by that thing. You don't even have to be hard. Once again, you don't have to be hard to orgasm or even ejaculate. So, you know, I often use these tools for my patients as well. And in terms of, like, I always say, hey, listen, you've got a million different ways where you're trying to come, whether it's Cialis, Viagra, why not help your partner come if they need to by bringing that toy in too? So it's all like synergy, right? It's 2 + 2 = 5. There's nothing to be embarrassed. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, guys, don't be embarrassed that you can't make your wife come or your partner come during sex with just penetrative sex. Guess what? Most people can't. So bring in the stuff that they can penetrate or can orgasm, because that rocks, that rules. That's when you're going to get off and you're going to have a good time with your partner.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like the only area of human activity where I feel like we're so stigmatized to use an assistive device, right? Like, yeah. I am wearing glasses right now and I don't feel like less of a person and go home and cry because I wear glasses. I'm like, oh, it's awesome. I'm wearing glasses. I'm not going to walk into a wall, and it's legal for me to drive a car when I wear these glasses. That's amazing, right? So, like, why not use an assistive device to have amazing sex? That's awesome. It's no different.
I agree. And Ashley, I think maybe we talked about this on the prior episode you're on, but I kind of blame a lot of this on how we're taught about sex via both pornography and run-of-the-mill movies that have sex. Because I can't think of a single sex scene in a non-pornographic movie where they use a toy of some sort to help them. It's always like the guy and the girl having sex and orgasming at the same exact time. And it's just, there's no digital use. No, he's not, you know, diddling her while he's doing it. It's just like the cover's in the perfect way. And then 3 thrusts and it happens, you know, like, I think it would be nice to see that. If anyone knows of one, I want to hear about it. Send it to me. I would love, I mean, don't send me the movie, but like, tell me, because I don't think it's ever happened. And I challenge Hollywood to make that happen. Michael Weber, if you're listening, screenwriter of 500 Days of Summer, prior guest, make this happen.
Oh, okay? That's what top five movie for me. I love that movie.
Be the guy. Yeah.
I would say 40-year-old virgin, the final scene where he first has sex, is one of those scenes where it was like, she's like, oh, you came. He's like, yeah. And then they do it again. And then it was better the second time. But that's the only one I could think of right off the top of my head.
No, I mean, my husband's a comic, and he has some joke about that. Like, you don't have any sex scenes where the guy is just like sitting there with his like hand, like, you know, diddling a clitoris. But it should, because that's like, if a partner enjoys that, that's a normal thing to do.
Correct.
Like, and also the movie sex position is always like the two people sitting up facing each other in bed, which is like, that is not most sex. Like, that is like the worst sex position. Like, what is that? Like, there's no leverage
that's
that way.
The only sex position I've been doing because of the movies, that you can have sex in other ways.
Like, they don't even have missionary anymore. It's always just two people sitting, looking at each other in bed. And I'm like, if you're going to do this sitting, looking at each other, do it on a couch or something. But no, people are sitting, looking at each other in bed. That's not.
No, it's not very realistic.
Always the way they do it. It makes me so mad. The worst.
Oh, all right. Okay, we are coming very close to the amount of time I have allotted for this, and I need to let you guys go soon. And there are a lot of listener questions. I don't think we'll be able to get to them. Maybe we'll just have you guys back at another time, and we'll do this again. But there was one that came up a number of times in the emails. This is one of those times when I solicited listener questions, and most of them came via email and not
nice, yeah,
like posting on Twitter or Blue Sky. But the one that was probably the most common is what is in female ejaculate? Did we talk about this last time, Ashley? I can't remember, but it came up again.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we talked about it last time. I feel like we talked about like the female G-spot last time, but maybe I'm remembering wrong. I don't know. But okay. I mean, the broad thing that people identify as female ejaculate is fluid being emitted during orgasm, right? Fluid being emitted from the urethra, right? So that can be a few different things. It can be climacteria, which Justin mentioned earlier. So it can be loss of urine during orgasm that happens in men after prostate cancer surgery because you've removed one of their sphincters, essentially. But it is easier to happen in the absence of surgery in, you know, people with female bodies because their urethra is shorter, right? So it's just urethra is shorter. You know, it can be a higher predisposition after having vaginal childbirth because there's a higher rate of what we call stress urinary incontinence or loss of urine during things that increase the pressure in the abdomen. So I mean, you know, it can be climacteria. And then there can be what we consider like a true female ejaculate, which is when fluids come out of those periurethral glands, right? So there are small glands that you can see, like if you look on physical exam next to the urethra, there are like openings of little glands. And those are the equivalent of, they release the equivalent of what the prostate makes. And so actually like there are studies where they've cannulated those ducts and they've found that they secrete something that is high in PSA, and that's prostate specific antigen. So it is really the equivalent of like the male ejaculate. Obviously there's no sperm in it. But so that does occur.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. It's like a rudimentary teeny tiny prostate, and that area makes not only pre-cum, right, which is a type of thing that makes women wet, but also can make ejaculate. So that's like the long answer. So generally I say to people, like if the volume is very high and it's very clear, like more likely to be some component of climacteria. And if it's like stickier and lower volume, then more likely to be closer to that, you know, periurethral fluid expression. So
fascinating. All right. Yeah. Very good. Very good. Okay. Well, there are more questions, but we'll leave it at that for now. And I'll just have to have you guys back on at some point in the future to discuss it further. I really appreciate your time. It was a blast having you both. Let's get the plugs in. Justin, listen, where can people find you and listen to you and maybe touch you? Where can that happen?
In a haunted house. Can...
In a haunted... Are you going to be in a haunted house?
That's where they can
somewhere?
Touch him. Yeah.
No touching in the haunted house, actually, just to be clear.
Oh, okay.
I jumped and I accidentally touched one of the actors and I apologized immediately, but no touching. I didn't want to get kicked out of it. But so I have a podcast called Man Up, A Doctor's Guide to Men's Health. Both Ashley and Kava have both been on it. So you can find that on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, Amazon. So give it a listen. Really appreciate anyone giving that a listen. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, on TikTok, my name, but I don't really TikTok. I'm very intimidated by it. Mm-hmm. House of Pod, I saw, just made a TikTok, which I'm now following. Ashley is also on it.
I've just given up all semblance of respectability. I'm just fucking selling out left and right. First commercials and now TikTok. I am
time, man.
Truly lost and broken.
You put too much time in this to not get some reimbursement. That's just the way it is. You're good at it and you deserve something in return. That's the bottom line. But you can find me at Justin Dubin MD. Is where you can find me on those things. And I'm in South Florida, Memorial Healthcare Systems. If you are in South Florida and you need to talk or you need to see me or you need a referral or any questions, just find me down here.
Right on. And it's a great show. I do listen to it myself. Ashley, what about yourself? What can we plug for?
Yeah, I mean, you can find me. I don't have a ton to plug right now. You can find me on social media mostly at Ashley G. Winter. So A-S-H-L-E-Y and then G like grape and then winter like the season. That's because I started most of my socials a really long time ago before I was a doctor. And then I just felt like I should be consistent with the handle. I used to have a podcast that I did 100 episodes of and then quit years.
It was very funny. It was a very funny podcast. It was very good.
And it has been, we haven't done any. Yeah. I don't even know if you can find it anymore. So don't look for it. if you're in the greater LA area and you want to come see me, just follow my socials and you'll get all that info.
Right. Also watch Curb for Her Husband when it comes
out.
I'll
let you all know when the thing will air. I mean, I think due to various shutdowns in Hollywood, like I don't even know when it's going to air. So,
I say viewing party. I think we should have a viewing party.
Yes, I agree. Amen.
Or at least like live tweeting or whatever.
Yeah, for sure. Amen. Amen.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you both so much. Thank you to Nadim for help with production. If you haven't already, rate and review us at iTunes. I really love it when I come across a review from you guys. And the emails are open again. And I am looking at them at hopquestions@gmail.com. That's hopquestions@gmail.com. Thank you both so much.
This was great. Really appreciate it. This was so fun.
So much fun.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready for the girl. I'm ready to save. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready to burn this fire within. Let's begin.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.